Mary redeemed a $50,000 cash prize playing Chumba Casino this year.
I was only playing for fun, so winning this was a dream come true.
Chumba Casino is America's number one social casino experience. It's serious fun. With over 80 casino-style games to choose from, you too could win life-changing amounts of cash. Be like Mary. Log on to ChumbaCasino.com and give them a whirl. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void or prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. The voice in the preceding commercial was not the actual voice of a winner.
Hi, welcome to this week's edition of Blues Talk. Again, John, Dave and myself. We're going to look back over Ireland's loss against Wales last weekend, the rest of the Six Nations action, and of course, look forward to our game against France on Sunday and the other two Six Nations games. So lads, a disappointing opening game. I thought it was a very good game, and just unfortunate the result. We lost 21-16 over in Cardiff the weekend.
Yeah, so to add to Joe Schmidt never winning a game in Cardiff, we're keeping on the Six Nations losses to Wales. They're a very poor team at the moment, as has been flagged pretty much everywhere by their own standards. But they put out the most experienced Welsh team ever to wear shoe leather, and you know they were there to do their bit. Coaching the issue has to be really Gatland gone and his fellow Kiwi Pivac in there. I just think obviously if we had a full complement, we probably would have won. We nearly did anyway, but for a few funny bits and pieces. I'm kind of gutted, but I'm kind of happy that they came back so well, they focused so well. They had to make up for missing a back rower, which is not an easy thing to cover, you know.
Yeah, I think it kind of shows where Wales are at for whatever reason, and because they have good players and they have a good coach, it's just they don't seem to be working together that well for whatever reason. That, you know, losing a back row player, losing a player so early in the match should be fatal, should be absolutely fatal. And it was, well, ultimately it was, but I mean, we were the better team for the first hour, 70 minutes. But we just made too many errors. Like, leaving aside the whole Peter O'Mahony thing, we made too many errors. Lowe made that error to bite in on the Reece Samet try. Keith Earls made that really unfortunate kind of twofer, where he gave away the penalty for challenging in the air. Then we won the line out against the head and he kicked it straight into touch. And that obviously led to, I think, the North's try. He was unfortunate there, actually, because it was one of those where you just operate on instinct. Everything happens so fast. Ball comes back. The ball comes to him so fast. And he just clears it. And obviously he didn't realize it was outside. But he hasn't been playing well for Munster. He didn't play well for Ireland. But you know, it wasn't just one guy's error that lost us that game. There was a number of errors, and
there was lots of them. And there was, like, I mean, Ringrose tried to offload the ball, spewed forward. He, you know, when he should have probably held on, one bloody time he does decide to pass, he knocks it on. Murray should have gone down on the ball. He couldn't control it. It kicked through. I think Navidi picked it up out the back door and went along the line. Likewise, you know, Sexton missed a relatively straightforward penalty to touch, which he should have got. He did the same against New Zealand in the quarterfinal of the World Cup. You know, players are human. They make mistakes. Yeah. Like, obviously, you know, we have to touch on Billy Burns incidents, you know, but like, the end, like I got texts, I saw loads of stuff written online, never play for Ireland again, a disgrace, you know, anyone would be better than him, my granny would be better than him, all the usual stuff. Like, I just thought very, very unfair. The guy made a mistake. You pointed out, you made a great point, Dave. Took a lot of balls for him, not choking, took a lot of balls for him to go for 5 meters or 1 meter from the line. Yeah. And he got it wrong. Plenty of other players, far better players than him in the past, have missed touch and kicked the ball dead. Rugby, or sports, and particularly rugby, is a team game. You win together, you lose together. One person's mistakes don't, like, don't necessarily, you know, cost your team. Plenty, between the two of us, we've listed off a litany of errors that happened throughout the game. And all of those things contributed to the final result.
Well, that's it. I mean, one of the things that really irked me during the week or in the aftermath of the game was people were calling Burns a bottler. I mean, what he did was the opposite of bottling it, as you alluded to. Guy, if he was a bottler, he would have gone for the safe touch. But he was trying to help his team win that match. So he pushed the envelope, and it didn't work out for him this time. As somebody, as I think it might have been Chuck Yeager said, if the thing about pushing the envelope is that's where the stamp goes. It's also where they cancel the postage. But you know, that's what he was trying to do. He was trying to get his team as close to the line as possible to win the game. And you know, we often complain about players taking the safe option, conservative option. We talk about conservative rugby, you know, and we complain about it. Well, we can't really, having done that, we can't really complain about when a guy goes for it, you know, and does what he thinks is the right thing to try and win a match. So, you know, I look, players make mistakes. Sexton missed one the other side, as you said, he missed one to touch. It happens. It happens literally to the very best players.
Yeah.
Look at how two of the most highly rated out halves in Europe played on the day previous. You'd own Farrell against Finn Russell. You know, and they both, you know, were dreadful. So, you know, it happens to players who are far more lauded than Billy Burns. So I don't know why I don't understand why there's this need to abuse the players to their virtual faces that you see out there on social media. What, like, people atting players in dreadful comments. And I mean, there's no need for that. A team loses, right? You learn from it, you put it away, and you go out the next day.
I have no time for that horseshit, like hiding behind faking hashtags and, you know, Twitter accounts and abusing players, saying shit that there's no way you'd say to their face. Now, we've said stuff on here that we probably wouldn't say to the guys' faces either, but like, I think we tried to be a little bit objective in it. And, you know, it's only sport, lads. Yeah, we're all pissed off we lost, but nobody died. It's a game of rugby, you know. You win, you lose. You have to move on and forget about it. Part of the ethos of rugby is you know, cheering the other team into the dressing rooms, all of that stuff. You don't get into toxic crap online. Like, just, it's just not what the game's about. I don't understand the mentality of people who do it, but you know, there's all sorts of people out there. So you know,
the late Pat Geraghty, who I'm sure you both remember. Used to run the official Irish rugby message board for him. And he once said that it's all very well been clever and smart under an assumed name. How many of you would do it under your own name?
Yep.
It's true. But like, I think, you know, probably broaden that argument or debate out. It's kind of it's a problem that's in our society that you're either a winner or you're a loser. And we oscillate from this, you know, you're either the hero one day or you're the zero the next day. And like, life isn't like that. Like, you know, there's an awful lot of gray in between. But I mean, it's like, for instance, Leinster, you know, if we don't win the Heineken Cup, it's a disaster of a season. You could get to the final and win a Pro 14, but it's a disaster because we didn't win. Like, what about all the other currently 19 teams that are in the Heineken Cup that didn't win it? You know, but if we don't win it, it's a disaster for Leinster. Like, it's that kind of, you know, we put up a braver performance today than we have put up on Sunday than we did winning matches in the recent past. Like, that was a brilliant performance to fight on for 67 minutes with 14 men. Wales aren't particularly a brilliant side, but they're an international rugby side.
And very experienced.
Also, Billy Burns has four caps. In the build-up to the game, Ronan O'Gara was, you know, talking about experience, and he said, your first five international caps are a blur. He said, you don't know what's going on. You're getting used to the whole environment. It's such so different. It's such a step up. You're used to playing at Pro 14 level. Occasionally play a few matches of Heineken Cup and then you're in. He said, the difference is vast. And it takes a while to adjust to that. Billy Burns played, I think that was his fifth cap for Ireland at the time. He'd played four. you know, he's no experience coming into an environment like that. And unfortunately, he made a mistake, but I really hope it makes the man.
Well, that's it. I mean, even at that, Jason, you talk about, he's played the odd European game. The European rugby is only really close to international rugby once you get into the knockouts. You know, it's and even then, not necessarily. And Ulster haven't played a huge amount of knockout European rugby. And neither did his previous club. So, you know, it's a huge step up for the guy. The irritating thing is we lost. And then you look back at a lot of the individual performances and they were superb. I was just going to say Tadhg Byrne, I thought was excellent. Robbie Henshaw was excellent. I thought Hugh Keenan was excellent. I thought CJ Stander was really, really good at number 8. Not my favourite position for him, but I thought he was really good. I thought he was really kind of resolute. Ian Henderson, who hasn't been in great form, came off the bench and played really, really well. Josh van der Fleer played well. I mean, there was a lot of really good performances. It's just, as we said, you know, in small errors, not even individual errors, but an accumulation of errors are what did for us in the end. You know, there's a lot to take out of the game in terms of positives. Obviously, there's negatives too. But, you know, the positives should outweigh those. How much use those positives will be on Saturday or this weekend, I don't know. But, you know, there are positives to take out of that game.
Well, Do you know one thing that struck me watching it was, like, when we were about 15 against 15, the amount of times we kicked the ball away, some of them were good, some not so good. I really disliked that tactic, but you know, maybe if you win matches with it, as we kind of did under Smith, you know, you might turn a blind eye to it. But I don't like it. It doesn't enthuse me. But
Eddie Jones,
it was almost there you go. I don't like the way he plays either. But it was almost as though our plan A had to change. I didn't think it was particularly working well. We were 6-0 down. We were actually 3-0 down when O'Mahony received the red card, but the resulting penalty made it 6-0. But it was almost like a switch was flicked, that they said, okay, well, plan A ain't going to work now at 14. We have to be more adventurous. We have to go for it. And there was a willingness to try and run the ball. It was difficult. Like it was very hard for them to do that because you kind of had, obviously, they always had an extra man in defence because we were playing Henshaw in the pack. But, you know, I just thought that we changed our tactics and we adapted on the hoof.
I'm not sure. Yes, we certainly changed the tactics. I'm not entirely certain we changed it for the better. Certainly there was a lot more running with the ball, but to what end? I still think that we looked really shapeless. It's very hard to discern. Yeah.
No, I agree.
I mean, you look at other coaches, you look at Schmidt, you know how a Schmidt team's going to play, you know how it's going to attack. You might be able to stop it, but you know what's going to come. You look at Eddie Jones, it's the same. You look at France under Galtier. You look at Ireland with Andy Farrell and Mike Catt. It's not that they're unpredictable. It's that there doesn't appear to be a shape there. And a lot of what we did, I mean, admittedly, was good because they're good players and they're able to make it work. But a lot of what we did was very off-the-cuff stuff. I mean, the stuff Robbie Henshaw did was not a plan. He just got popped a ball and went for a wander in the lead up to the try. That was three players.
A similar move it was a similar move that he did against France when he actually scored the try. When he went around the blind side, made a breakthrough. This time he was tackled but was able to offload to Van der Fleer, who took it to the line, and then Byrne dived over for that. But he scored similar opportunistic try against France in November.
I was going to mention the 2 second rows that finished the game. You name checked both of them as having a good game, Dave, and I would agree with you absolutely. I was particularly impressed with Byrne. Byrne is the kind of guy, I think I said about him last week, that I'd probably see him on the bench because he's a 4, 5, 6, 8. He can play in all of those positions. So he's the kind of a lock. He's not a heavyweight cart horse of a lock. And neither is Henderson. You know, the two of them would normally be the Victor Matfield rather than the Bakis Puta. Whereas James Ryan, James Ryan could also be so athletic for such a big 6'8" body of a cart horse guy that he could, and he's very fast. But basically, to finish the game with those two guys, and you've got Alan Wynne Jones. I know he's only 6'5", but he's a real powerful tight head. Look, and Beard, who is 6'8", the same as James Ryan, and is young, but he's a very powerful guy. He's probably about the same age as James Ryan, I'd say. But you know, the two of those power athletes up against two guys who can, because Henderson can play in the back row as well. So you've got two guys who are 4 or 5 sixes, or 4 or 5 6 8s, and they're both having to take. They also both have to cover, to use those skills to cover for an absentee in the back row. Mm. So how they managed to fill all those roles was pretty impressive. You know, line out as well. I thought they were, and then obviously you've got Josh van der Fleer, and yes, we had Henshaw in the, that was only on our attacking scrums, though. He wasn't in line outs or mauls or, you know. So, and he wasn't even in defensive scrums. We were scrumming with seven. But they did an awful lot of work. And that, I suppose that's why they got a bit ragged towards the end, because they were having to do the work of an extra fraction of a player. And if you look at it in the pack, the second row and the back row, that's four guys were doing the work of five. You know, that's really the way it was. So I was impressed with all four of those players and how they showed up. And if James Ryan is out this week, then you could see the pair of them start together, which is, you know, against France, who are a bit serious. So we'll see how that goes. We'll get onto that later. But for now, I was very impressed with the four of those and how they covered up the loss of Peter O'Mahony.
The entire front five and indeed replacements were very impressive. One thing that I was worried about, and I think I might have mentioned it last week, was that Keane Healy has always had problems with Thomas Francis. And I was a bit worried about that, but he got on top of him this week, or last week. Thought he had a very good game, and the entire front five had a really, really good game. Well, the entire front, what was it, 5, 9, had a very good game. You know, I thought they all played really, really well. It's very hard to analyse a game like that, because, you know, you're talking about all these guys who played well, and then you look at the score and we lost. But, you know, you have to take the positives out of it. You have to take the juice out of it, you know, and there are a lot of positives in the game. How many of them would be useful to us going forward this weekend remains to be seen. But I would suggest that the video session on Monday morning wasn't as nasty as it could have been.
Yeah, well, I totally agree with you. As you say, the bench came on, and like that probably did us in France. That I didn't, you know, our bench was considerably weaker when we played France in that delayed Six Nations game. Whereas the guys that came on all made significant contributions. Henderson came on early enough, and then I thought, and I'm surprised, like that we persisted with Murray for 72 minutes, and you know, I would say that the difference that Gibson Park made when he came on, the speed that he was taking the ball away from the contact area in comparison to Murray was, you know, just chalk and cheese. It was light years quicker. And I thought Furlong, as the game was going on, Porter, I thought, geez, he's having one of his best games in green. And then Furlong comes on. I'm thinking, oh my God, like, if I was a selector, who would you pick there? Porter couldn't say anything to criticize him. But Furlong comes on, and God almighty, like, he was a blunder.
He ran down Lewis Sammet.
Yeah.
Imagine Mike Ross doing that.
Imagine Mike Ross running.
but there's Furlong, you know, there he might be the impact sub, you know. Who knows? But look, I mean, what do you think of the I can't remember the guys now. Was it the centre that went off with a... I thought his head hit Ringrose's shoulder. He had to go off concussed, but there was calls for him being yellow carded if he had to stay on, or even red, but I actually thought he hit his head at his shoulder.
The incident left, I mean, maybe he hit my head, but the incident left no impression on me whatsoever. I think it was a bit of, I think there's an element of, yeah, but look what the other boy done about it.
I didn't see any, I only saw it a couple of times, but I didn't see anything wrong with it. We'll come back to Ireland in a few minutes, but let's just get the other two games out of the way. Our opponents next week, France, put on 50 points on Italy. Like Italy, again, they just sadly fail to deliver. They show a few glimpses of great play and fall away then. France put 7 tries on them and looked pretty good. And Dupont, I mean, he was just special, really, wasn't he?
Yeah, he's... I mean, in a way, you'd have to feel sorry for Italy because they played all the rugby for the first half hour, 40 minutes.
Yeah.
And played a lot of good rugby. And then, like, they'd have... They do all this good stuff and then they drop the ball or get turned over. It would go up field. Well, was it Matt Williams said they scored... one of the tries they scored, they didn't even... France didn't even have to pass the ball once. France went 95 metres without passing the ball. Because Italian ill discipline.
Yeah, they gave away 2 penalties and just kicked both ones off the line.
Yeah, I mean that's crazy stuff. And then obviously the Dupont thing was a moment of magnificent skill from Dupont to put what's the name in under the post. But that was an Italian ball that went to ground as well. You know, so
Van Sant was it?
Well,
Van Sant was that the guy's
Van Sant, yeah. But that was, I mean it. Italy were playing well, and then you just get, there's only so many of those dagger blows you can take before you're exsanguinated, you know. So, and then France ran away with the second half, simple as that. They have a lot of good players. I still think there's a weakness there. That France team is not, it's still not the 70s, it's still not the late 70s, early 80s yet.
We'll see
on Sunday.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a good team. It's a good French team. I'm not saying it's rubbish or anything, but I'm just saying it is weak. There are weaknesses there that can be exploited. I mean, it's been a while since France have won a game in Dublin. When was it? 2008?
10 years. 2011.
Yeah, 2011. Sorry, that's a long time.
Yeah.
I mean, and they've been reduced to some fairly desperate tactics on occasion to try and get wins. I mean, do you remember the time they tried to get Sexton's ban extended by a day?
Yeah,
not as his injury
that as well
ended by a day, so he'd miss the game against France. I mean, it was
just on the news earlier, giving 8 yards, Mr. Sexton.
Yeah, we'll come to that. The other match of the weekend was the Calcutta Cup match. Scotland running out 11-6 winners and should have probably been 21-6 winners, really, but they couldn't convert their. Certainly their possession into points. But like that was Scotland's second win and a draw over England in the last 4 years. So they, you know, Gregor seems to have their number.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about that Scottish team is, I mean, obviously a lot of the talk in the Scottish team revolves around Hogg and Russell, and we'll come to Russell later. But Hogg I always thought was really, really good, but I mean, I never quite drank the Kool-Aid. On Saturday, I drank the Kool-Aid. I thought he was magnificent. I thought that was the performance of the weekend, even more so than Dupont, because Dupont, at the end of the day, was playing Italy. I thought Hogg was absolutely brilliant.
He's playing the Premiership day.
I thought that was a world-class performance from Hogg. I really did. I thought he was absolutely brilliant. And I think that's the Lions 15 jersey nailed down for him.
Well... I think that Hogg had a great game, undeniably. He did blow two games, I think, against us. Maybe it's the last two games against us with a few mistakes. Mm. One where he knocked the ball on over the line, and you know, so he has
been high pressure environment of the Premiership job.
that's what's brought him. It's the relegation that you know, the fear of relegation that has made him the player he is in the last couple of years, but. Finn Russell, as you said, what a shit show. He was absolutely awful with the boot. He couldn't kick shit off a rope or snow off a rope, should I say. He was terrible from a place ball. He missed touch. He threw a few nice passes occasionally, but generally they won despite him rather than because of him, which is, you know. And also, you know, let's not get too carried away on the Scottish performance. You know, they were playing against a team that a lot of their stars hadn't played a game of rugby since last autumn because they played for Saracens.
Five starters from Saris.
Yeah.
Well, there you go, you know. I mean, that's going to bite us in the ass because we've got them last and they're going to be well bedded in by then. But
Billy Villapola looked about 2 stone overweight.
He did.
Like, yeah. But I mean, I'm not saying he should have gone and you know, benched them all or not picked them all. But if a guy isn't able to, I mean, he could hardly jog off the pitch.
Yeah, he didn't look in. He looks like one of those guys who needs to play to get fit. I don't think he's ever going to get fit in a gym. Billy Vunipola, I mean, we've all known guys like that. I mean, we were never that guy. But we've all known guys who can only get fit through playing. I think Billy Vunipola is one of those guys. But sorry, just to go back to Finn Russell, I describe him on Twitter as Schrodinger's out half. He can simultaneously both win and lose you a game, often at the same time. He does immensely brilliant. I mean, on Saturday, he did some things that no other out half in the world could do. And then on Saturday, he did things that no other out half in the world would even try to do because they're monumentally stupid. So, you know, you pay your money and takes your chances with Finn Russell, but no team that's ever going to win anything is ever going to win anything with Finn Russell.
Well, we see. I just think Scotland are a little bit flattering to deceive. And they're like, they made hard work of that against a team that were in shit form. And look, I'm thrilled for them. They won for the fourth time in their history in England, which is, you know, or fifth time, sorry. And, you know, we've won 4 this millennium in Twickenham alone, not in the last 150 years. So whatever hoodoo the English have over them in Twickenham, they finally, you know, we were saying, myself and Dave were saying earlier that none of the team were born the last time Scotland won. In fact, Gregor Townsend was in primary school and he's the coach. So, you know, it's such a long time between drinks there. So with that in mind, I'm absolutely thrilled for the Scots and I don't mean to be poo-pooing their victory. It's a huge thing for them and I'm very happy for them. But I don't think they're going to win a Grand Slam.
I was going to say.
I hope they prove me wrong.
The sellers of Scots related tat on the Royal Mile won't need to stock up on Grand Slam t-shirts.
Hopefully.
But there was a few really good performances. I think your man Van der Merwe is.
Yeah, Doohan, yeah.
He's got
a named after the Irish folk singer Johnny Doohan.
Yes, that's right. And his brother's named after some other singer.
Acker Bilk. His brother is Acker van der Merwe. He's named after Acker Bilk.
No way.
Yeah.
That's pure madness, eh?
But like, and then you had Hamish Watson. Like, you know, standout performance. Even your man Gray. No, you have reservations about him, but he was really good as well. Like,
no, I thought the boat Grays when Richie when he came on, I thought that he was really good. I thought boat Grays were good. Scotland's pack played really well. Sometimes it's felt you can target that pack because the front five isn't as great as it should be, but they played really, really well and really put it up to England. Really, I mean, it helped. Yeah. It helped that Itoje had one of his less intelligent days, and Billy Vunipola wasn't there, and they were without.
He was occasionally penal. He reminds me of Richie McCaw. You get almost immune from getting penalised for being offside. Like, he's not offside all the time, but he's
on Saturday he got
very,
caught.
Very close. Yeah.
On Saturday he got caught. And they were without Mako Vunipola and Kyle Sinclair, who are big players for them. So.
And when Ireland have had success against them, they're normally missing one of their three contingent from those in the pack, either one or two of the Vunipolas or.
Itoje. Yeah, it's so.
Anyway, it was great. It was good for the tournament. Sorry, just it was very good for the tournament that, you know, it's not just France and England going to be at the fighting it out someone like Scotland can come in and upset the apple cart, likewise, what they did last year, I mean, they denied France a Grand Slam by winning against France in Murrayfield.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's always nice to have a relatively flat hierarchy in the tournament. And it generally works out that way. I mean, despite all the fears of them doing so over the last 40 years, England and France haven't disappeared over the horizon into the distance.
Yeah, well, like, you know, there's always been that fear, hasn't there, that will happen.
I was asking you guys, and you never replied to me. I asked you on WhatsApp, I think, about how did you know? Because we were calling at the end of the game, or at the end of the show last week, and I said that England would beat Scotland, and you both went for Scotland. And I'm just wondering what you saw in there that was it just the rustiness of England? Was it?
Yeah. Yeah. Too many players playing too few games in England,
and even the English clubs gave their players 2 weeks off.
Yeah,
when those two European Cup rounds were, mm-hmm. you know, they were postponed or cancelled. So they're
operating under the pressure of the Pro 14. You see,
yeah. Well, turn our attention to next weekend. Obviously, we take on France. I'm surprised by this statistic that over the last 15 years, we've won 6 games, including 1 World Cup. They've won 3. Last 11 games, including the World Cup in 2015. We've won 6, they've won 3, and there's been 2 draws. So, I mean, I can't remember a time watching Ireland-France, you know, that they would have a considerably worse record than us. You know, when we were growing up in the 80s, like, I mean, you just didn't beat France, or you might got the odd victory against them in 1972 or something.
There was
we used to thrash them in my day back in the 40s.
Well, that's because they were at war, John. When we were growing up, there was no expectation of beating France and very little hope of beating France. Now, there's an element of expectation about playing France, especially in Dublin. Now, it's obviously different with no fans there. But, you know, it's a very different vista that we face when we play France than there was 30 years ago. And that was, I mean, we were talking just a moment ago about the fear that England with its, you know, 40-odd million people and France with its 60-odd million people would disappear over the horizon in terms of competitiveness against Scotland and England and Ireland and Wales in particular. But that hasn't happened, and it hasn't happened with France. France, to a certain extent, there's an element that France kind of fluked into a really good team in the late 70s and early 80s. And I've never, and 80s, and I've never really replicated that once the game went professional.
Hmm. Yeah.
I mean, they've had good teams who can peak. The one thing France can do better than anyone else is peak for a World Cup.
Yeah.
But, you know,
they're going to do it again.
Yeah. I mean, but the stuff that goes in between, it can often be pretty poor. I mean, we set the World Cup aside. We obviously don't, you know, we don't really, anyway. But France seem to peak for World Cups, and in the interim, they can often be quite poor. So it's always hard to know what you're going to face with France, particularly when they go away from home, and particularly now there's no crowds there.
Well, I'm a bit worried about this French game now. I have to say, one thing is, it's in our hands. We have an opportunity here because obviously every year in the Six Nations, 3 teams after round 1 can win a Grand Slam, maximum of 3 teams. Two of the winning teams are playing each other in Wales and Scotland. So if we can beat France, everyone except one of Wales or Scotland will have lost a game. So that throws the tournament wide open. If we can't beat France, then France are looking good. You know, France are on a slam and we're on a hiding. Losing to Wales and France in the first 2 games, that's it. You know, it's damage limitation after that. So maybe the fear of that might get our performance up to scratch. And maybe the French will still have a little bit of a screw in their head coming to play us in Lansdowne Road, because not many French teams, whether it's Toulouse in the Heineken Cup or whoever in the Heineken Cup, come to Lansdowne Road expecting to win. And French teams in the last, since, I don't think there's anybody on the team who was there in 2011, the last time they won in Dublin. So some stato might prove me wrong there, but you know, that's a pretty young team. So hopefully we might have enough fear in their heads to put them off, and a bit enough fear in our heads of losing two in a row to come out and kick the living crap out of them. So I'm hopeful.
I think you're right, John. Just to tail on to the end of John's point about, you know, the screws and heads and stuff. The other side of that is from an Irish point of view. The great thing about the European Cup is that guys from Leinster and Munster in particular, and to a lesser extent Ulster, are used to beating French teams. You know, those guys don't hold any fears for them. So, anyway.
Yep. Which, going back to the 80s, we never played them. Mm. So the only time we saw Stella and Blanco and all these lads was when they were running past us and scoring tries in the corner.
We saw them.
You know, now we see these lads and they're just human beings like everyone else. But I do think that France are afraid. They know that they have a very good side, but I think there's been an orchestrated campaign to try and turn a screw in Ireland's head. The two doctors came out over the last couple of days giving interviews to Midi Olympique about whether Sexton was fit enough to make his return, whether he was, and Hooker has come out as well and said that it's up to Sexton, but if it was me and the amount of knocks he's got on the head, I certainly would be putting my family ahead of my rugby career. I think that they are trying to somehow or other offset Sexton. It's not the first time a French team has done this, particularly to Ireland. Think back to the World Cup in 2007, when I think we played them in the pool game, and they started to drop rumours in the press that Sexton, that O'Gara had a gambling problem, and then that he was falling out with Kidney because he was caught having an affair. These things, this is just mind games that the French are trying to throw into the mix. And I hope, and like I saw Sexton in his press conference today, he came out and he said that the rumours are sad, shocking and inappropriate. And I hope he takes some sort of civil action or legal action against that doctor for breach of patient-client confidentiality.
Back in the 1920s, when the Soviet state was struggling for legitimacy, there were a number of prominent writers in the West who would big up what was happening in Soviet Russia, ignoring things like the massive famines that were killing millions of people and the Kulakization that were killing millions more. They would big up what was happening in the Soviet Union and cover over its faults. And they were known in the Politburo as useful idiots. Now, in other news, I see that Rory O'Connor from the Irish Independent decided to cover all those stories in Midi Olympique. I'm not drawing any connections there. I'm just pointing it out.
Yeah, fair enough. And of course, decided, like, they off the ball AM have 2.5 hours every morning to try and pad out. And this was also a lead story on it for quite some time. In fact, they got your man. Do you remember the guy, was it John Coughlin that used to play for Munster? He's now coach down in Greve. Yeah. Well, they had him on, more or less, having a similar kind of conversation about concussions and how aren't the French right in pointing this out, was Joe Gilroy's argument.
Well, here's the thing. When serious journalists and serious sports medical people question why people don't take things like mildly traumatic brain injury seriously, this is why. When teams use it as a tactic, the same way as you would use closing the roof in the Millennium Stadium, or the same way as you would use watering the pitch, it reduces the gravity of what is a very grave situation for a lot of athletes. I believe there's over 100 or 150 ex-rugby players who've signed up to a class action suit because of the way their lives have been negatively impacted by the way that their concussions were treated. I mean, that's a serious thing. I mean, I have nephews and nieces. You've got kids. You've got a daughter, Jay, who plays rugby. You want her to play, and I want my nephews and nieces to play in the safest game possible. And doing things that undermine the most serious issue in rugby and using it as just, you know, another tactic, like a press leak or whatever, that's very dangerous stuff. It's a dangerous game to be playing. And I hope the guys, mm-hmm. I mean, I hope those guys in the papers don't end up with blood in their hands.
Well, anyway, Johnny, yeah. Just to put that one to bed, Johnny was not a happy bunny. I saw him earlier. He was, they've got to him. If that was their tactic, then it's worked, because he's really pissed off.
The thing about getting to Johnny, they tried to get to Johnny again was it 2015 when they did the same thing, or was it 2016? Anyway, they tried the same thing and he came out and absolutely demolished them. Brasterow ran into him, if you recall, head first possession of the game. Yeah. And Johnny left him sprawled on the pitch.
Yeah.
And
Eddie
Jones said something similar, saying that he'd be frightened for him and his after his parents, that's right. So
annoying Johnny Sexton is a double-edged sword.
Yeah, well, hopefully he will. We don't know, obviously, the composition of the team. We don't know whether he's going to make. He's going through his protocols. Likewise with James Ryan. We do know O'Mahony is out. They've drafted up Jack Conan into the squad. I thought I read somewhere that they've sent back Gavin Coombs to Munster. Maybe they want to give him more games. I don't know.
So they obviously feel that him getting game time there rather than holding tackle bags in Carlton House is a more beneficial use of his time, which is probably true. Can't be playing games.
I want to come back to something about that when we kind of get through the Ireland stuff, okay? So we're obviously going to have to rejig our team. We don't know the composition, whether James Ryan plays or not. But presuming he's out, I mean, if he went off and stayed off after, what was it, 25 minutes or something like that, his substitution was on. You know, so you've got to think that maybe Henderson comes back into the second row. Would you keep Byrne in the second row, or would you move him into the back row? Or is there too much rejigging?
No, it's. I think I said to you just before we went on that what they're going to do is bring in Reece Ruddock for O'Mahony, and anything else will be injury enforced, i.e. they'll have Henderson on instead of Ryan, and they'll have whoever on instead of Johnny Sexton, whether that's Burns again, or whether they bring in Ross Byrne or Jack Carty or whoever, or they pump something into Joey Carberry and make him miraculously good as new just for the weekend. But whatever is going to happen there, you know, if Sexton makes it, then and if both Sexton and Ryan makes it, I predict the only change to the team is going to be Reece Ruddock in, who a lot of us said should be there. He's a form six in Ireland. It's, you know, yes, there are lots of strategic reasons for having Peter O'Mahony there. Fair enough, but you can't ignore Reece Ruddock's form. And as somebody said during the week, he's never started during last week. He's never started a Six Nations game for Ireland. Isn't that incredible?
Mind-blowing statistic.
The guy is playing 10 years. He's playing since he was a teenager. He got called to an Australian tour in the senior team from the under-20s, as far as I remember. So he was still a teenager when he made his debut, and here he is 10 years later, and he has never started a Six Nations game. That's insane. So I'm Peter O'Mahony's misfortune is his opportunity. And if he plays well enough, maybe he'll hold on to the jersey after whatever it is, 5 weeks. I think Peter O'Mahony is going to be able to face England if
he's there for three significant matches.
Yeah, or 5 weeks or whatever. Anyway, so it's the 15th of March or something. It's just before we play England anyway. So what do you guys think? I don't think they're going to, you know,
I think they'll keep changes to a minimum. Might see some more. Again, it depends on injuries. If Ryan and Sexton come through, the only change anywhere will be Ruddock in for O'Mahony, and they bring, I presume, Jack Conan onto the bench. Maybe.
Okay, so
but I don't see them making any other changes.
That Sexton doesn't make it.
Yeah, well, they'll start Burns. He has to now. I mean, you can't. Your starting out half isn't available. The guy who you believe is your second best out half because you have him on the bench, they can't drop it. They're not going to drop him, especially because that would be seen as a commentary or a review of what happened in the final seconds. And he has been his go-to number two guy.
Well, you think, like, say, Jack Carty was the second, say, the backup out half they brought to Japan. He played against Japan, they lost. I think he played some of the Russia match. They struggled for bits of that. And he's disappeared. He person non grata nearly now. You know, he was playing okay. I didn't think he played particularly brilliantly for Connacht, but he orchestrated the game against Leinster, which they won. And then obviously
he did have a great game.
Sorry, what's that?
He did have a great game in that game against Leinster.
Well, he did that game, but he just has more than one game, John, you know. But like, because they beat Leinster in that game, it was media clamour about him being.
He hasn't been consistent yet. The way he has
been consistent enough. Exactly. Like,
I'm not entirely sure the threat that Billy Burns has, but I mean, he's been the incumbent in one of the more successful provinces. So I suppose.
Ross Byrne is your other guy. Nobody else is. Ross Byrne and Jack Carty, unless you're bringing back Ian Madigan, who's 30. I wouldn't rule it out, but it doesn't look like he's getting a go. And Billy Byrne seems to be first choice in Ulster, so the old rule of thumb, if you can't get into your provinces team.
I heard a very interesting argument in favour of keeping Burns, was that Andy Farrell has been a professional rugby player so he's been involved in rugby in a changing room environment since he was 16 years of age. And because of that, there's obviously, I'm sure, we've all played in teams, you have a very strong bond and loyalty to those people in the changing room. And it's hard to divorce yourself from that when you change from being a player to a coach. But your scene has been loyal. Most important thing that you have is your loyalty within that changing room. And he's shown loyalty to his out half, who's under enormous pressure. You give the guy one more chance, you know, rather than just he had 20 minutes that he wants to forget, that he hopes for, he'll never repeat it again in his career. But you give him a chance of redemption. You don't just cut him off and go, see ya, move on to the next one. Because if people make mistakes, they're never going to get a chance to learn. They're just going to have one go, and if you don't get it right, you're gone. That's true. You don't have the resources to do that.
Of all games that to be going into with an out half that's low on confidence, you know, it's not the one to be going into.
But if he's selected for this game, he won't be an out half. Farrell's thinking will be he won't be an out half who's low on confidence. He's an out half who'll be. You say, well, my coach really trusts me. The team trusts me. The way the captain spoke about me after the match. It could be a galvanizing thing for him.
Yeah, absolutely could. But, you know, and then, like, again, on a bunch of friends of mine, we were just discussing, would there be a possibility that they would start Jemison Gibson Park in this game? We kind of came to the conclusion, no, because of the threat of DuPont, that they want to keep what's our perception, right? Sorry, our coach's perception of his number one, which is Murray. You know, not bringing in the reserve, even though we might say, oh God, Gibson Park deserves his place ahead of Murray. In the coach's perception, they see him as number one, and they want to mark number one against their most important player, or their probably the best player in the world at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Well, apart from anything else, I don't think the way we're going to beat France is is in a shootout. You know, I think the way we're going to beat France is, I don't want to use the phrase drag them down to our level, but play a game of rugby that they don't want to play, and a game of rugby that we're very good at. All our provinces are good at, because we're used to the conditions and we're used to the game. And I think Murray's a better guy for that than Gibson Park.
Yeah,
could be.
If you had a choice, right, of a guy who was going to rain accurate balls down on top of Teddy Thomas, who would you pick?
Ross Byrne.
I want the kicking game to be accurate. Because if
you said accurate balls on top of Tiny Tama.
Yeah, I know you did, but it has to be accurate, because if we give those lads a couple of meters of space, they can reap massive rewards, you know. The ball, the minute that ball lands, someone has to knock them backwards.
I'm pretty confident that most of the time Murray puts the ball where he wants to put it.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that we want him to put the ball there, but I think he knows what he's doing, and I think Farrell knows what he's doing. Mightn't agree with it, but I think he knows what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think he's doing what he wants to be doing with it.
So we're pretty much saying that there's only going to be minimal changes just coming in for if two lads are injured or if they're HIAs, they don't come through. And obviously, minimal changes, just bringing in a like-for-like for Mahoney, product for Mahoney.
Here's one. What would you do? Keith Earls, by all accounts, and by all of us pretty much agreed on it earlier on, he's not in great form for either Ireland or Munster. He's 33. He's not getting any faster as a winger. I mean, don't get me wrong. The guy has enough in the bank to stay in the team. You know, he's a very dedicated and very good player. But at the same time, if you were to replace him, who would you put in there? And you're not allowed to say Dave Kearney, because we don't say that.
Well,
Simon Zeebo.
Jay?
I said Simon Zeebo, because apparently he's talking up his potential return to Munster.
When he signs the contract, he's eligible for selection.
Yeah.
Look,
let us know next week, he said.
Well, here's the thing about Keith Earls, right? Seeing as Dave Kearney is, for whatever reason, persona non grata in Irish camps these days, who else is there?
Jordan that was Larmer, exactly what I was going to get at.
Yeah, Jordan Larmer has flaws. Balakoon is out injured. Stockdale is out injured. There's nobody in Connacht. I mean, Conway. Who else is there? Conway. Conway is the only other option. And Conway has been out of form as well. And I suppose the question is, who is playing the least worst at the moment? I mean, Keith Earls has it in the bank. Keith Earls has been a world-class winger for Ireland for a long time. If he can go to the well one more time, because, you know, is there much difference between Earls playing badly and other guys who aren't as good as Earls anyway?
Yeah, and you could also use the Rob Kearney psychology, where Joe Schmidt went to him and said, you need to have a big game this week, and he did. So, you know, maybe Andy Farrell can go to Keith Earls and say, you need to have a big game this week, and hopefully he will. That'd be great. They could dial one in there for Keto. He'll only be 35 at the World Cup, or maybe he'll be 36. But
if Dave Kearney were in the squad, that'd be the argument. But he isn't. And Stockdale is out injured, and Balakoon is out injured. So, you know, who are you looking at?
You've really only got a choice between Larmer
and Conway. And
Conway.
So,
yeah, that seems to be it.
Yeah. So, I just wanted to cover the other two games briefly. So, England take on Italy. Really, it's in Twickenham. So,
Is Sergio going to be in a requirement for this game? Did I see that somewhere?
Is he?
I saw somewhere.
Who?
Sergio Parise.
No way.
He's not retired. He's coming out of international retirement.
Is he still playing? He is.
Yeah, he's playing for Toulon.
Well, England at home in Twickenham for the second game in a row against Italy, who are at best a rebel.
They're going to murderize them.
If England lost this, it'll be history-making, and it would signal massive alarm bells. So I think there are about as much chance of England losing this game as any potential thing that can happen in a two-horse race.
Italy will be close, and they're thereabouts on the 30-minute mark, maybe even the 35-minute mark. And then by the 40-minute mark, England will have a bonus point. And by the 80-minute mark, England will be heading for 70-odd points.
Okay, we'll replay that one to you next week.
Yeah, well, like that debate still lingers, doesn't it? And it's getting stronger and stronger now, particularly from the British, whether they're Welsh, Scottish, or certainly the Welsh and the English. I heard Sam Warburton talking about having some sort of playoff between Georgia and Italy every year, which I don't know whether it would work, but the old chestnut is, have they run out of patience with having Italy in it and becoming the whipping boys? France put 50 on them this week. So let's say England win all the remaining matches and France drop a match maybe to us. And so it's all neck and neck coming into the last round of games. And it comes down to points difference. It means France have a plus 40 on England. And France have a plus 40 on Italy. You know, we only put 35 on them, and England put 42 on them. You know, that's how the championship is decided. So it's not really fair.
Well, it is really fair because everybody plays Italy. Everybody has a chance to put 40 on them. Everyone has a chance to put 60 on them. You know,
depends if you play them home. If you play them home or away, say.
Yeah, but sure, that's then every second year it's fair, and every second year it's fair. Every year it's fair to half the teams, and every.
But like something does need to be done. Would you not agree with that? Like, yeah, I don't know what. I couldn't tell you the answer, but something does need to.
There's not only one answer really. There's two. One, carry on the way we are. Two, go back to the Five Nations, because Georgia are fucking nowhere in terms of A, their form. They're, you know, Italy would beat Georgia more often than not. Plus, Georgia is 4 hours away. It's in fucking Asia, right? In fact, it is in Asia, if I'm not mistaken. So
it's not. It's in Europe.
Travel, it's in Asia, but anyway, we won't argue about it online. You can look it up later. They've no money. You know, they're not a rich country. They've got 4 million people or so.
They're not
bringing a huge amount financially or population-wise to the tournament. They're 6 billion miles away, and they're not any better than it. They're definitely worse than Italy, maybe not by much. So there's no argument there.
They gave us a good fright last October or November.
Fair enough. But, you know, that's an on their day situation. Yes, on their day, they can come very close to any team.
That's one of the worst Irish performances of the millennium, though.
Sure. I just don't see it. It's just never going to happen. There's 60 million people in Italy. Okay, a lot of them don't follow rugby, but maybe a bigger percentage of Georgians do, but the potential money-wise in Italy is just miles ahead. The population is miles ahead. They're the furthest away, but they're from Ireland, but they're still, you know, you're only halfway to Georgia. You're not even halfway to Georgia when you're in Rome. It's not going to happen.
I mean, Italy has a large population, as you've mentioned. The wealthy industrial north of Italy is where the game is based. If you look at it, Italy have never had problems. Even in the Pro 14, when TV deals have gone down, they've never had problems replacing them because, you know, there's plenty of TV interest in rugby in Italy because it appeals to blue chip consumers. And Italy have always brought plenty of money to the Six Nations, plenty of money to the Pro 14, and never had a problem getting either TV or that money. They're a wealthy union. And on top of that, they are progressing. I mean, you look at the performance of Italian under 20 teams in recent years. They've gotten much, much better, and they've become a significant thing. I mean, so much so that, and I'm sure we discussed this because everybody seems to be discussing it. They were able to pluck Garbisi out of last year's thing, and he doesn't look entirely out of place in the Six Nations after coming from the under 20s. So, you know, the only way you can hothouse it, you're not going to hothouse Italy by chucking them out of the tournament. You hothouse Italy by improving coaching and giving them increased opportunities.
Yeah. Well, I'd agree with you, but I think there is a groundswell now starting to get concerned. I think it's 29 games now that they've been beaten, haven't won since 2015. Like, that is a significantly long losing streak.
Whenever anyone starts on that, I point them towards the win-loss of Ireland in the 80s. And 90s.
We won three championships in the 80s.
in the 80s, sorry, the 90s, I meant. I mean, there were guys who went nearly their entire careers without winning a match.
There were. But don't forget, back then, France and England wanted to break away and possibly join some sort of Australia, New Zealand, South Africa hot pot, you know? And yeah, jettison the Celtic countries, do you remember?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it was all in sort of turmoil at that time.
But they didn't. That's the point. They didn't. They stuck with it. Look at how it's worked out for them.
On memory, England were kicked out of the championships, and I think
they were kicked out of Six Nations for selling their matches to Sky.
Yeah, and then they eventually they come back in.
Yeah,
Five Nations. Yeah,
yeah. That just shows. I mean, they sold their matches to Sky, so they were thrown out of Five Nations and replaced with Italy, which brought England back into line, and that. Italy had enough money to be able to replace England, you know, that brought the Six Nations about. Unfortunately for Italy, it probably came maybe a year too late, because that great Italian team kind of retired en masse and hung on and hung on and hung on to get into the Six Nations. And in fact, they did win their first Six Nations match, if you recall.
Pardon? Was it against Scotland?
It was against Scotland. So that was the tail end. That was the tail end of the Troncon Diego Dominguez halfback partnership, which they haven't really replaced since. In fairness, the current incumbents look, you know, promising.
They beat Ireland three games in a row.
In the 90s.
Prior to joining the Six Nations,
they beat everyone. Sorry, Jason. Just to say, in that series of games that they played, as if you like the unofficial sixth member, they beat everyone except England.
Yeah. And from memory, it's the only fixture that they haven't won in Six Nations.
Yeah.
Is against England. Like, we've even taken France during probably 7-8 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just a pity. Like, I thought they would have gone under Conor O'Shea, and sadly they didn't. And even there was a lot of optimism that when they joined the Pro 14 that it would open up their players on a weekly basis to playing against better standard of opposition than their own national league, and certainly would have given their younger players an opportunity to develop.
Is there 12th team in the Pro 14?
That just hasn't seemed to work forward. And like, it's not like that we know ourselves that the Pro 14 is chock-a-block of brilliant sides. There are some very good sides in it, of course, but there's a lot of fairly average teams. But the Italians are struggling to rise above the lower placed Scottish teams.
You talked about them giving an opportunity to younger players, and it has. Problem is that they keep getting pinched by Gloucester.
Yeah, that is a factor too, of course.
The two best, if you like, young backs that they produced in recent years, Minazzi and Campagnaro, both got pinched when they were barely out of, you know, one season of Pro 14 rugby gone. So the FIR, I mean, the Italian Federation does have questions answered about its player retention. I mean, it certainly does.
Again, they're in the same position as Scotland.
Yeah, but these are young guys, Jay. John. These are guys who only played one season.
True, yeah.
Okay, moving over to the other games weekend, Scotland against Wales. I was just looking at the record over the last 15 seasons this time. Wales have won 12 of those 15 games. But the Scots won most recently in October, the end of October. They beat them in
Connacht. First win in Wales in a decade.
Yes. So they have, as I mentioned, they've won two of the last four encounters against Scotland. Have won two of the last four encounters, whereas, you know, for 6 or 7 years they didn't beat. Close to ten years that they didn't beat Wales. So like, their form is certainly improving, and you can see the sort of progression that they have been making, particularly the results, as we mentioned, against England, two wins and a draw, and they've had two wins out of four of the four previous games against Wales. You know, when we played Scotland in that sort of final of our final of the Autumn's tournament, Eddie O'Sullivan was on either whatever station was RTE or AIR or whatever was showing it, basically saying Scots have failed to deliver, and they, you know, they talk a good game, but they don't really have nothing to show for it. By looking at those results over Gregor's last 4 years, they actually are improving. You know, they were coming from a very low base, obviously. But then they didn't show up against us on that day. And, you know, we beat them when we played them in the World Cup. But they definitely are improving side.
I think they're an improving side. I think they're a developing side as well. They're bringing through younger players. Maybe not all of them are in the squad or in the team, but they're there, thereabouts. The question is, they have to do it when it counts, Jay. That's what Scotland have to do. Now, you could say that beating England is that, but, you know, it's one thing to beat England and then lose to Wales. That would be a very Scottish thing to do in terms of rugby. So backing up that win against England, that's the next step for them, where they're backing up games and putting together a series of wins that might take them to a trophy. I don't think they will. I'm not saying that Wales will beat them, but I would certainly not be surprised in any way, shape or form if Wales did beat them.
Yeah, I concur. On form, you'd have to say Scotland are going to win. It's in Murrayfield too, isn't it?
Yeah.
Am I correct? Yeah. So you have to see Scotland there as favourites there. However, favourites lose sometimes. And who knows, maybe Wales will finally click. Like, they're just, as we said earlier, it's a hugely experienced team. They're just playing. I think maybe it's shown a couple of things. Pivac has been rumoured to be off fairly soon, and he could be, you know, fighting for to finish his contract. He could, you know, that's why he's gone so conservative with the eldest Welsh team, or the most capped Welsh team in history. It's what coaches do when they're under pressure, is they go for all the most reliable, experienced players and take feck all chances. So that could just pay off, and they could go up to Scotland unfancied and stick a hole in Scotland. But you'd have to say, if the game was played 10 times, you'd expect Scotland to win more than 5 in Murrayfield.
But if Scotland was coaching, expect Wales to win.
Yeah, if Scotland was coaching, yeah. Something like that. So we'll see. It'll all be revealed at the weekend, gentlemen.
I just want to have one little chat before we go about, heard a podcast, I think it was the RTE podcast, and they mentioned, and I thought it was quite interesting, they're talking about broadening our playing base, right? So we've got 4 teams. We know the union's under financial pressure. They're hardly going to, you know, set up a fifth province at this point in time. So they're not talking about getting rid of, you know, the frontline players. Keep them contracted to Leinster, Munster, Ulster, Connacht. But it's the guys below that, rather than stockpiling them. And I just had a look at, for an example, if you look at our back row, right, and I'm sure a couple of these mightn't be there at the end of the season due to retirements or, you know, attrition, whatever. But we've got Van der Fleer, Darris, Reese Ruddock, Connors, Cohen, Levy, Josh Murphy, Max Deegan, Scott Fardy, and Scott Penny. That's 10 names I've read out there. Like, I get it. It's a very attritional position. You might need 7. So we've got 10. And I'm sure I've missed out a couple.
But here's the game against Dragons next week, of those 10, we're without 8 of them. Yeah. So we actually have to pull in another guy from the academy.
But there are, you know, within contracts, callback options, right? So if you send a guy out on loan, let's say to Rotherham, for example, right? Or I'm just picking a team. So you send Josh Murphy over to Rotherham and you say, right, you're going to play some hard-nosed rugby and you're going to play for the next 3 months and get, well, it's better than holding tackle bags. Because where else is he playing? Because he's getting feck all games.
Do you think
he's going
to play in Rotherham?
What?
Why would Rotherham want him?
No, hold on. I'm not talking about COVID now, right? Okay. I'm talking about when the season's in foot, when we're back to normality. Yeah. So you've got 10 or 12 guys. I mean, okay, take an example of of, say, down in Munster, right? You've got out halves. So you've got Carberry, Ben Healy, JJ, Jake Flannery, and Jack Crowley. So I've named five out halves there. Like, where are they going to play? So you've got, you know, Carberry is going to be involved with the national team, possibly Ben Healy. Then you've got three other guys. Like, where do you bring through the Jack Crowleys to make sure he's going to be the new kid on the block? Or likewise, if you look at our out half position, you've got Sexton. Okay, Sexton's not going to be around forever. That's fine. But you've got Harry Byrne, you've got Ross Byrne, and you've got, say,
Frawley.
And then you've got Hawkshaw. So where does Hawkshaw learn? Like, going back and playing with UCD, you know, like...
My question is...
These guys should be playing professional rugby against other professionals.
Not well, Rotherham Titans...
And then step them back.
Rotherham Titans are not a huge bit above UCD, to be fair.
Yeah.
Pro D2...
Hold on. I gave that as an example. Okay.
No, but I mean, like, for example, right? Okay, so I understand what you're saying. It's not unlike the loan system in soccer, where you'd send a guy to, you know, it doesn't have to be Rotherham. It could be Ealing, one of the better championship clubs, or even one of the lower national or premiership clubs, right? And that's fair enough. But what's in it for them?
But they get the opportunity to have, let's say, just for argument's sake, we send Hawkshaw over, right? So Hawkshaw was captain of the Irish under-20s team that won a Grand Slam. He's considered highly enough by Leinster that they've brought him through the academy, that he's played 5-10 times, whatever it is at the moment for Leinster. That, let's say, I'm thinking of a team, just say Nottingham, right? I don't care. Whatever team in England.
London Irish.
Ealing as an example. So you say, well, Ealing, you're going to get this guy for the next 8 months. So you're going to get a season out of him, but you're going to have a pretty good guy, probably better than the guy you currently have. You're going to get this guy. We're going to pay half the salary. You pay half the salary. However, there's a clause in the contract that if we have an injury crisis and two of our out halves go down, we can call him back. And we can call him back on a day's notice. And tough luck for you.
But you get the that guy. Rugby, I say that's a great idea, except for that last clause. Fuck off.
Yeah, but like, I mean, these things are in the contract, Dave. You know, they are included in contracts.
They are, if you want to play them at a level that's higher than the level they're going to get in Ireland, you're not going to get that into a contract. Sorry.
Right. Okay. But like, I think I'm not so sure about that actually. But look, we can pause that. But like, there's so many players on Leinster's books that are not getting exposure to bring them through quick enough, because, and I'm supposed this is coming back from the international. So you've got the Irish international squad, right? At the very start going back to the autumn internationals, I remember having a rave and a rant that we did what wasn't experimental enough. They announced the Six Nations squad for the opening two matches. Again, I didn't think it was a particularly good squad. They weren't bringing in enough younger players, but those younger players that are like, they're, you know, like, where's Harry Byrne's progression? Why is Harry Byrne the same age as some of the French guys who have been, you know, brought into the French squad and given the opportunity to learn? And those guys are going to be at the peak of their capable powers when they're in their, you know, 23, 24, 25, and that's when they're going to be playing in the World Cup. Like, Harry Byrne is not going to be going to have the experience for the World Cup.
I have the solution, and it was one that was posited before, and at the time, the guy who posited it, he's the chief executive of one of Ireland's premier provinces. I'm not going to say who it is, but they're the only one who've won a Heineken Cup recently, tried to get his A-side into the Guinness Premiership A League, who wanted them, but the RFU said no, or negotiations broke down at union level, shall we say. The four Irish provinces A teams should join the Premiership A League.
Yeah, well, look at.
And the Premiership A League would actually be very happy to have them, because of the perception that Leinster, Munster, Ulster and Connacht have very strong reserve teams, and it would bring on their players as well, and we'd still keep them on our books and under our control.
And I wonder why there was that, why that was knocked back. Was that to do with the clubs, I wonder?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Yeah, it was the club game where not happy that these guys were going to be just taken out of their orbit entirely. Because as things stand, like the Leinster A players play for the clubs. So.
Yeah, well, I mean, I would seriously suggest that playing for UCD or Lansdowne or Gary Owen or Ballymena is a step down from playing professional rugby, because you might be a pro, you might be training with the pros, but when you go back, you're playing against guys who are in university or working, who aren't as fit as you, or, you know, not giving you the same challenge as if there was another, that you were lining up versus 15 professional players.
In all fairness, Jason, we've seen that in the previous B&I Cup, where the Premier, or the Championship sides were playing against our academy teams. And that's exactly what was the case with them. And they are professional, at least some of them
are, not all of them.
Semi-professional.
Yeah, they're getting slaughtered.
They were getting lashed out of it. And we were seeing guys who were super fit young academicians coming up against lads who looked like they, you know, drank a lot of beer and showed up in a Sunday league, kind of, you know, big old-fashioned looking props that you'd see in the AIL. So, yes, of course, the championship in England is a higher standard than the AIL, but I don't think it's as much ahead as people think, you know? I don't think Pro D2 in France, maybe a bit.
That's a tough, hard man's league.
That's a serious, exactly, a hard man place to play. So if you were going to form alliances and let players go on loan, and there's a good bit of money in the Pro D2 as well.
There is. So it's probably the third richest league in Europe.
You know, let them go to the Basque country. It's a bit of an Irish Basque connection. Seems our genetic heritage comes from that region.
I do think we do have to get our players more games. Jason is 100% right. I don't think a loan system is the way to do it. I don't see how anyone benefits. But I do think either moving our A teams into an integrated competition, whether it's in England or France, I think we have to do something. Because I was doing some, there's been a lot of talk about how France gave, were so willing to give Entomac and Jalabert an opportunity when we're not willing to take a risk on younger players. I would argue actually that they didn't pick them because they're young, they picked them because they're good and they've no fucking choice no matter, because the rest of the outhalves in France are shite. But anyway, that France have 14 teams that play over 360 games a season between them in their domestic league. We have four who play 84. The big fucking difference when it comes to giving opportunities to young players, on top of which the expectation on certainly Munster and Leinster, and to a lesser extent, but still strong Ulster, is that that our teams win every match home and away, Europe and domestically, every match home and away. So there's huge expectation and pressure on Leinster teams and Munster teams and Ulster teams to do well, which reduces the opportunities maybe for younger players. Whereas in France, that isn't the situation. In France, for a good proportion of the games, the fans are hopeful, not expecting. And you give it an opportunity to, I mean, if you look at the away selections for a lot of French clubs, you'll see an awful lot of young players picked in those selections. Now, there's an element of, they don't quite go the sink or swim route that Cheka did. They are a bit more sensible in blending them. But the culture of French rugby and the number of games available means it's possible to bring through young players. Now, they're not great at it. Because in France, the attitude tends to be, if a guy isn't a star straight away, fuck him out the door and get an Islander in, which is what they do. So they have their own issues, but they do have more opportunities to give to young players. And they do tend to do that, at least for one or two games.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, we've agreed that players have to be brought through quicker because, you know, when are they going to bring through Parry? You know, he's sitting there currently, probably fourth choice Irish out half. Where's he going to slip to when Carberry comes back? Fifth? You know,
the analogue I don't like is I don't think it's fair to be comparing Harry Byrne to, we'll say, Roman Entomac, right? I don't think it's an accurate comparison, because Harry Byrne, okay, he's not getting game time, but the guy ahead of him in terms of, like, for Ireland is Johnny Sexton, or for Leinster is Johnny Sexton, who is still the best out half in Ireland. Roman Entomac is the best out half in France. There's no other guy who's 26, 27, 28, 29, 30, et cetera, who's better than him. The third choice out half in France is Thomas Ramos. Right? That shows you the dearth of out half talent in France.
Mm. Yeah, it's I don't know, but like I think that A league, but I think it's going to come up against, as it probably has, a brick wall by the clubs, because the clubs will want the players.
Yeah, we do have to do something. We have to do something to take that 84 games available to the Irish provinces and turn it into 160 games. We have to. Mm.
Like I think the opportunity, or the relationship, say, with London Irish as an exile, you know, where I'm not sure if that could ever, it'll ever go back to the way it used to be. They're a professional entity. They get money from the RFU.
Yeah, at the end of the day, London Irish are part of the RFU's development pathway into the England team. And in fairness, they are. I mean, the whole, we have to divorce London Irish, the amateur club, from London Irish, the professional franchise. You know, London Irish, the amateur club, are still, you know, a great place for exiles and those away from home. London Irish, the professional club, are a professional rugby team. They play, they're part of the England pathway.
Exactly. Anyway, boys, as ever, thanks a million. Thanks very much for watching. If you are following us on Facebook or Twitter, please give us a like and a subscription. And thanks again. Cheers.
It's fun to go twice as hard as everyone else this time of year. That's why Dunkin' doesn't stop at just one signature holiday latte. So they made two, both handcrafted with rich espresso and topped with whipped cream. The holiday classic Peppermint Mocha features notes of mocha and cooling peppermint, while the toasted white chocolate is complete with creamy white chocolate flavor and cinnamon sugar dustings. They'll help you show the holidays a thing or two. America runs on Dunkin'. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer. Terms apply.